has it was did I ever do anything when you were first in this year about methodology in general? Did I ever take out Shiram? Yeah, but I stopped doing the last couple of years. At the beginning, I know. And I, for whatever reason, I decided best not to do it then. I might have, your first year in this year might have been the last year that I did it. You would have been there too, Shalom. So, anyway, so some of the materials I can skip. I'm not going to talk about Yerushalayim because I take that sort of as a granted. One of the questions about the use of Mechkar, listen, when I first started doing this, the Dean of Reeds at the time, I'm still the Dean of Reeds, but, you know, said to me, because there's certain people who were coming and whispering in his ear, primarily because, I'm not going to say how they found out, but one of my students had an article by Shama Freeman in his place, which had nothing to do with Shir, it had to do with a rebel course he was taking, but, you know, the way the Malshinim and the base matters work, so he runs out, Rebbe. So anyway, what's that? I don't know, maybe he's well, so, you know. So anyway, I have to tell you about Shama Freeman, regardless of ideology, I'll just comment, it's always nice to say, I don't want to be so lavish in Zecher Tzadik Vracha, but I found him to be, I never met him personally, but in exchange, an incredible mensch. He's from the Bar Ilan School of Scholars who think that the idea of pursuit of knowledge is to share it with the world and make everything available to as many people with the hopes of being Magdil Torah or Magdil Torah Mada Umadira, as opposed to the Hebrew Youth School that believes that when you get your hands on something, you keep it close to your vest and you don't let anybody see it until you've sat on it for 60 years and published your book. So the world has to be deprived of that. So he's an incredible mensch in terms of when I needed stuff and out of nowhere, he had no idea who I was, and he just was actually so nice sending me photographs of Tosefta manuscript because the microfilm had parts of it cut off, the standard microfilm. So I have to just say he's really a real mensch, putting aside anything else. So what the Dean of Reed said to me, he doesn't have a problem with me doing it. He knows that I don't know how he knows, I hope it's true, that I have Yerushalayim. That was a comment you made at the time. I think there's a degree of, whether I do or don't, it's a separate question. I think there's a degree of truth in that. But I think that if a person doesn't have Yerushalayim, and Emunas Chachamim, not in the modern sense, but in a broader sense, and Kvod Chachamim, then it's better he not study Torah, no matter what his methodology, whether it be a Brisker or a Mefalpel or a Choker or any other kind. It's better that he, you know, just go study literature and the Mishnah.
No value?
So I'm not going to talk about that. I want to really focus on the question of methodology and just sort of give you an overview of the various issues, and some which I'm not going to dwell upon. Firstly is the question of text. I had text context, I forget what it was, and history or something like that. I don't remember anymore. I have it somewhere. In the issue of the question of text, when I talk about text, I mean in two ways. Number one, the question of Shinir and Ischaos, and we've seen already a few this year that are really of significance. And the other question, which is one of the issues we're going to explore in Ksubos, is even when you're not talking about Shinir and Ischaos, because all of our manuscripts and all of our printed editions happen to have one particular reading, but sometimes you have to realize that even though everything seems to be Ola B'Kana Echad, that's not, in fact, that is not what the Amoraim or Tanaim may have had in front of them, or even the Gemara had in front of it. And therefore, you have to be willing to count them as that possibility. And that's this example I always cite of giving a Chabura to a group of Gush guys in June a number of years ago. And I presented them one example that we're not doing. And the answer to the question was that the Amoraim didn't have the text of the Mishnah as we have it. And none of them, I set it up. I lobbed it over the plate. And not one, and all bright guys, really serious, stark bright guys, not one of them could thought to respond and saying, well, maybe they just didn't have it in their Mishnah. And, you know, and it was so once you point it out, it's so obvious. You know, it's hard to miss it. And the signs are even in the Mishnah. The signs of editorial activity and interpolation are there in the Mishnah Idias, but they simply couldn't see it. So you have to be able to see things. Anyway, so those are the two things that I'm going to get to when I refer to text. And obviously in these areas, I'm not concerned when I talk about Shinuskos. I don't care about whether it's spelled Malay V'chaser, whether it's abbreviated or not abbreviated, any of those things. That's interesting. Or even the forms of the word, which can be very interesting from the perspective of language, that's sort of irrelevant to the base medrash. In that sense, a better model, in rare cases, yes, sometimes it does, but, you know, but in most cases, even though the only problem, I mean, he did an excellent job, although there are errors. But in that sense, the best work in terms of Shinuy and Ischaos in some ways is the work of the Duque Sofren, because he didn't mark minor variants. He only marked major variants and things like that, and those are the parts that might be somewhat much more. I mean, he had some things that still are not of that are shinim or mabekach, except from the perspective of the text is a little different. But nonetheless, once you've already narrowed it down to his block, that's already a better tool. The point is, again, a minor. You go pick up the Duque Sofren. If any of you haven't seen it, it's printed in two different editions. One, the newer modern one. I mean, the newer version, which is just a way, I guess, of saving paper, whatever. They print these two very big Gemara-sized volumes. The older style, there was printed Mesechta individual. Otherwise, it's obviously the same thing. And you'll see on top, all he has is the Fuss Vilna and Ksav Yad Munich, which is not necessarily a good manuscript, except that it's virtually complete Shas. And you see, just open it up, and you'll see that some of the things, it might be Amar Leah Baya L'Rava, and he'll just have Amar Baya L'Rava, right? In other words, the absence of the anticipatory pronoun has no effect on meaning, but it's not just a linguistic difference, whatever. Also, I don't need to sort of tell you that one of the major differences, one of the things that Mechkar has introduced to the base Medrash, or introduced a greater emphasis on, is the use of a broader range of texts, particularly the Yerushalmi and the Midrashei Halacha, and maybe even Midrashei Agada, but more Midrashei Halacha. These are things that are not unique to Mechkar, but it's a question of the dagish. What kind of an emphasis is placed upon it. Obviously, the interest in Yerushalmi and Midrashei Halacha and that all this other rabbinic literature other than the Bavli is something that began even before the time of the Gra. The Gra made it, the Gra may have certainly advanced its cause further. And certainly Rishonim, the Ravid accuses the Rambam in Hilchos Kriyas Shema. Some of you have seen it, I hope, by now. The Rambam accuses the Ravid. He says that the Mechaber is sometimes darko l'halach achar Yerushalmi. And he wants to know why he didn't quote a particular Yerushalmi, right? I think it's somewhere near the end of Hilchos Kriyas Shema. So the Rishonim certainly studied, but in terms of, the institutional memory of the European yeshivas, so the Yerushalmi had long disappeared from the map. Ezra?
Is it possible, what kind of other texts did the Yerushalmi have in front of them? Did they have all these collections that we have?
Well, let's put it this way. Yerushalmi did not have all the Midrashim that we have. They certainly had the Midrashei Halacha that we have, including some that we don't have, like the Mechilta de Rashbi, which was sort of reconstructed. They had Yerushalmi, certainly. One would love to imagine, although I don't know if it's been investigated, the parts of the Yerushalmi that were missing, but we know were there, like the last three or four Prakim of Shabbos, the last six Prakim of Nida. I wonder if the Rishonim ever quote Yerushalmi there that we don't have anymore, as opposed to Kutchim, which was a forged Yerushalmi, right? That was a modern forgery invention. As far as we know, there never was, or certainly it's not mentioned anywhere in Rishonim or anything else. Yeah, I think it was one of those jobs, yes.
They did that with
Yes, but that's explicitly knowledge as such. Yeah. That's the difference, right? No one was trying to pass that off. So basically... the Rishonim, for the most part, even Rashi has Yerushalmi's, not too many places, but I assume he had. It certainly wasn't the staple for many Rishonim, and they viewed the Yerushalmi basically as a handmaiden to a great extent to the Bavli. That's the one difference from the perspective of Mechkar, which, again, it's not that it's non-existent from the Rishonim or the Achronim, but it's a question of degree of emphasis. How much do you try to read the Bavli and Yerushalmi syncretistically, if I can call it that, as opposed to reading them as independent, or synoptically, is that when you maybe a better word? Well, syncretism is religious worship. Synoptically, versus do you read them as independent texts? And obviously, the tendency, as you saw in one of the questions on the Bechina, a number of you that I'm marked seven, so I haven't finished yet, but hopefully by next week I'll finish. A number of you missed the point. The reason why the Rishonim, reason why the Rashbam mentions the Yerushalmi is not because he thought that people didn't eat olives raw. That's why we thought the Yerushalmi was strange. They amended the Yerushalmi so it would fit with the Bavli. That was the point. Anyway, certainly, again, Nothing in Mechkar essentially is new that the Rishonim didn't already do. It may be a question of how extensively one uses it, but in terms of the general methodology, it's virtually all there. Realia, I'm not going to talk about any length. We've seen examples already where the knowledge of realia is very important. No thinking person can deny the importance of realia in learning the Gemara. I shouldn't say that. I take that back. Last time I made a comment like that, I got a blog attacking me. There are thinking people who seem to ignore the importance of realia, but I find it hard to imagine, if you think the issue through realia, why you would choose to ignore it. You know, the apples of the Gemara are not Platonic apples. They're real apples. And you have to know that. And that applies for all Metzias in the Gemara. We saw the example of the Kafrisin of Yonah in the footnotes of the Rav, where some Ahun didn't understand why if the Kafrisin are only a Shomer Lepri, and if it's not a Pri yet, then it's not a Shomer. So at that stage in the Gemara, why did he throw out the Avionos and eat the Kafrisin? He didn't realize that the Kafrisin and Avionos are never on one fruit at the same time. It's the Kafrisin on this part and the Avionos on that part, and that's why it's perfectly relevant to say that Avionos is a Pri, but the Kafrisin are never there at the same time as the Aviona. Ezra?
You said that no thinking person
can
ignore that stuff.
I scratch it from the record. There are a lot of thinking people who ignore it, but I don't understand really why when you think it through carefully.
When you think about Tanakh, would you say the same thing? Like, how could one try to understand anything in Tanakh without...
That's called Pshuto Shomikra. And I think the Rishonim who were interested in Pshuto Shomikra, starting with Rashi, you know, from the firmest of Rishonim interested in Pshuto Shomikra, I don't think would have denied its value. In fact, I don't think if you even saw the Hamavaser piece, the interview with Rav Schechter, and he, you know, he made almost the argument for Yeshiva College Academic Bible right there. Pretty close. Basically, you know, if I take my favorite example of a psil, you know, by Yehuda and Tamar, I don't know how any thinking person, and especially in a case where the Rishonim clearly are struggling, they're not sure what it is, how could anybody say that you wouldn't want to make use of it there? Okay. Did you get in trouble when you quoted me? I hope not. I hope you didn't get in trouble when you quoted me.
No.
Anyway.
No, I said I argued with you on that for
you. Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Okay, now you agree?
Yeah.
Okay, good. See, I accomplished something. Okay, fine. And I think it's in reality, I always like to point that, and you've probably heard this in various guises from me, is not limited to their reality in the sense of metzias of things that we're not aware of, but also what they thought about reality. And I think I've spoken about the example of Dam Nechar Benaseh Schala, right? The Gemara's explanation of why a nursing woman doesn't menstruate. The Gemara is a machlokes, and one sheet that says Dam Nechar Benaseh Schala, that the milk the blood becomes cloudy and turns into milk. You have to realize, and I remember I actually told this to Schachter this morning, I pointed out to him Sternberg's article, where basically, you know, the way a lot of people try to explain is that, you know, basically the kochos of the body that are going into making one now going into making the other, which is actually, you know, very nice, but that's not probably what they thought, because at least as late as, and unless the understanding was different earlier, Da Vinci in his anatomical drawings shows a vein going from the uterus to the mammary glands. So the notion of Dam Necha Manasseh Shchalav was quite literal.
They view it as blood, or they just view it as blood?
Well, the Gemara says that the fact that chalav is mutter is a chiddush, because it's dam necham, according to the view, dam necham nasis chalav.
Is that why they thought that lo tashagdil chalav imo is aser, because you're cooking it in its mother's blood?
No, I don't think so.
No, it's because...
The third area that you have to realize, there is the realia that you have to know when you're dealing with, you know, botany, what foods they're eating, which they knew what was going on, basically. There's the realia you also have to be aware of what their scientific assumptions were, and you also have to realize that even in dealing with attitudes, it's very important. And I've cited examples of this, but one I still can't find the Gemara I'm looking for. Schechter also thought the Gemara exists, but we couldn't find it. About one of the Amoraim telling certain people that Rabbi so-and-so Paskin X, even though he didn't, because they would listen that way. And it seems very disturbing to us. Now, we couldn't find that Gemara, but I did find a Gemara like that, but I think there's a different one, where Rab and Rabbi Yosef were going on the way, and Rabbi basically had to do with the Tchum Shabbos and where your center of Tchum is located, and he told Rabbi Yosef a particular din, and he cited a Bryce in the name of Rabbi Yosef, and the Gemara says Rabbi Yosef never said it, but he told it to him so that he would listen, because we always pass on like Rabbi Yosef. Okay, so Bryce and the Gemara and Ervin Nunalf Amad Aleph. Now, you look and say, this is very, very disturbing. In fact, Rav Schechter mentioned the Maritz Chayis asked a question. There is a sifrei that says, Lo sasig minayin lemachlif divrei Rabbi Eliezer Rabbi Yeshua v'divrei Rabbi Yeshua Rabbi Eliezer sh'over b'lo sase. If someone misattributes one to the other, how do you know he violates a law? Lo shenemar, lo sasig gevul reyachar asher gavlu rishonim. So the Maritz Chayis asks, so how could Amoraim do such a thing? So I just make, I mean, aside, they're not exactly parallel. I'm not going to answer his question, but just to point out, their attitude was different than ours. The Gemara Pesachim, Daf Kuf Yud Beis, Amud Beis says, in Bikashta Lechonek, it's Rabbi Akiva's statement, Bikashta Lechonek, Lechi Talei Be'ilan Gadol. which you read the Gemara straightforward, sounds like if you know, want to hang yourself on a big tree. It means attribute to an Adam Gadol if you want them to listen to you. Now, the notion to us, you know, it's the inverse of Yeshiva College plagiarism. Imagine if you wrote a paper and you footnoted books that didn't exist. That would be very clever. We never had such a case that I'm aware of. What's that?
No one got caught that.
That's true. Well, they usually just don't. They don't need to make up citations. They can write this kind of nonsense on their own. But the point is that their attitude was fundamentally different than ours. The Ramban, I would say, the Ramban would have vadai, no matter how you understand it, the Ramban would have been convicted of plagiarism and thrown out of Yeshiva College. He cites material from the Ravid. Rav Shechter mentioned to me lots of material from the Ravid in Taras Kohanim. He cites material of the Northern French Parshanim, and he doesn't attribute. In most cases. Now, what I'm led to believe is that, you know, the highest form of flattery was plagiarism. You took their ideas and you took it, sort of presented it as a given. Now, today, that's unacceptable. Now, again, Chazal had an idea of Omer Davar B'Shem Omer, maybe Geula La'olam. So exactly what the Ramban is doing, I'm not sure, but whatever his reasons were, he still would have been hauled in front of a panel and expelled from the college. But the fact is, the attitudes have changed. Pseudepigraphy, it's the same thing. I've said this before. The two deos about the Zohar are not, it's a 13th century forgery, it's written Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. The two deos are, it's a 13th century pseudepigraphy, or it's written Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And there's a difference between the two. Forgery implies that's a way of negating and nullifying and denigrating it. Pseudepigraphy, we don't relate to pseudepigraphy in the same way, but to them, that's what you did. You wrote a book and you titled it by, you know, that was the thing that you did. So we don't do that anymore. But anyway, so you have to be aware of the fact that attitudes can change. What we might deem something very strange, they might have deemed as perfectly normal. Okay.
The historical context is included within that.
What do you mean by that?
Meaning trying to understand the historical context of the.
Yeah. Well. And yes. I mean. So that's a broader point, which I'm not going to touch upon so much, but is an assumption of mechkar, which you don't have to be working with the mechkar to accept. Is that? But it certainly emphasizes it more. Is that there is a social context to rabbinic literature. More on that you can see also from Schechter's interview. He said something that I found to be very interesting because different than things that I've heard him quote before. You know, and I don't, you know, the piece about the someone asked the Rav, you know, someone said that it was because they didn't have wood and so on. So the Rav said, you know, someone in Shir said he thought it was apikorsis, and the Rav said, no, it's not. But you still have to be to explain. So it means that forced them to come and look at the halacha again. Which I'm surprised that the Rav actually sort of, I mean, acknowledge that, but he did, at least according to Schechter in this interview. So I think that, yes, social context is important in terms of dealing with things. Dr. Ellman has done a lot of work. I mean, that's the really area he's trailblazed. He didn't create the whole notion of social context. He's certainly working on the element of law, you know, a comparative law. I think it's clear, and we've spoken about in the past when we did Shabbos, you know, potential differences between Eretz Yisrael and Bavel. There, even in terms of traditions of halacha, but situations of mitzias, and also that the Gemara itself will highlight a difference between social realities. You know, between Bavel and Eretz Yisrael, whether you should get married first and then learn, or learn and then, you know, get married and so on. The Gemara acknowledges whatever exactly the distinctions were, social distinctions between, you know, geographically. So all those, I think, are relevant. The areas that I wanted to focus on, I think, most important. So all these are true, and we'll encounter them, the questions of reality, the questions of variant text. We'll encounter them, we have encountered them, and I think you understand their importance. But in terms of the meat and potatoes of learning, the impact of mechkar can be felt in one way, and that is the question of layers in the Gemara. Now, you've seen us do this, some of you have done this more formally. We haven't done so much of it formally this year. In fact, I moved away from that. But the notion, there is in scholarship, American academic Talmud scholarship, a notion that was pioneered by Professor Neusner, which I believe to be, it's been demonstrated to be incorrect, but it's ironic that the very traditionalist camp almost adopts the Neusnerian position, almost. It's very different, but it's very much the same. His notion that the Talmud Bavli represents the work of one generation of, I'll use Barr's term from the Mishnah, of formulators, redactors, and that the seams are gone and that there are no layers and you can't discern sources. It's ironic because if you to take that to Chumash, you become very frum, actually. It's called the disappearing redactor, or the redactor who disappeared. Now, it has been demonstrated that it's not correct. It's been demonstrated by Richard Kalman that it's wrong. It's not true. I think it's obvious, but, you know, when someone states something as ridiculous as it may be, someone has to go back and sort of try to demonstrate how you can factually demonstrate that it's wrong. And he did. He did a fairly good job of it. But the implication for Neusner, and here's where the yeshiva world might depart company with him, is therefore he would say you can't assume that it's what Rav Shmuel actually said. It's what the editors of the Gemara want them to be saying. Whereas in the yeshiva world, they would say no, it is what Rav Shmuel said, but you know this is all in effect a unilayered work, and there's no point in trying to cut up into pieces. If, however, you assume that it is a multi-layered work, then there's tremendous ramifications for cutting it up into its layers for a very simple reason. If Rav says, let's take one of the examples we encounter this on Daf Lamed Vav Amud Aleph. If you have a statement of Rav that a machlokes Shmuel and Rav Yehuda as to what bracha you make on Kura, so the Gemara presents a machlokes and it presents an explanation. If in fact there are no layers in the Gemara, that explanation in effect becomes the words of Rav Yehuda and Shmuel. In which case, why did Rav Yehuda Paskin hold the way he did? Exactly for the reason the Gemara gave. If, however, you argue that there are multiple layers in the Gemara, and that the Amoraic layer, A, is distinct from the interpretive layer, and B, distinguishable, not just that they exist, but that you can actually distinguish them, so then you open a door to other possibilities of understanding the statement of Rav or Shmuel. In other words, if the Gemara is interpreting Rav and Shmuel as opposed to Rav and Shmuel having offered reason X, then it's possible there's an alternative interpretation. Now,
So what? If we find alternative interpretations, so what?
So then, the alternative interpretations are things that A, on their own, can be posited. And here, I refer you to an interesting source which is not 100% clear what it means, but the question of interpreting canonical texts in uncanonical ways. I don't mean halach l'maisa, but that general question. Do we believe in doing such a thing? So the Tosas Yantav, it's a famous passage in Nazir, Perakei Mishnah, comments about explaining a Mishnah where the Rambam seems to ignore the Bavli, when he explains, and I don't think this Yerushalmi supports him either, he just explains the Mishnah, you might say Kipshuto, but not the way the Gemara understands it. So the Tosas Yantav writes, he says, and I don't know what he means by that, whether he means the Rambam didn't mean lamaisa, or there's actually no nafka mina for whatever external reasons. Harishus nesuna lefaresh. Permission is granted to interpret. She'ein ani roe hefresh ben perish ha-mishnah leperish ha-mikra. She'rishuna nesuna lefaresh b'mikraos kasher inenu haroos chiburi ha-perushim shimimos ha-gemar. In other words, and he doesn't spell explicitly what he's talking about, but you find many commentators who interpret differently than Chazal interpreted Pesukim. Now, he doesn't talk about Agada versus Halacha, but certainly there were Rishonim who specialized in interpreting even Halacha in Halachic passage in the Torah, not according to Chazal. And when the Rashbam interpreted Tefillin as an allegory, you know, at least in one place, it's not necessarily because he didn't wear Tefillin, it's just because he was arguing for Peshuto Shel Mikra. So in the same sense, you can do the same thing to Mishnah. And in the same sense, you could posit an Amora, you could posit a different meaning for an Amora. Now the question is, why would you want to do that? And the answer is, on your own, you don't necessarily want to, you don't have any reason to, except that when you find another sugya that seems to understand things differently, or you find a Yerushalmi that seems to understand things differently, or you find other sources within the Gemara, not just per se a sugya that's oriented differently, so then recognizing the fact that the Amora could have meant something else allows you to connect his position to other places different than where the Gemara took it. Certainly there. I don't think there was even a shaila. That wasn't even a halachic context. He's just arguing in Briyasa Olam. Right? I don't think it's even a question. I mean, I know you were the one who showed me. Were you the one who showed me Ibn Ezra?
Yeah.
Who wrote that poem where he attacks the Rashbams? Are you there? But what's that? Yes. The truth is, Ibn Ezra, Rashbam was a much bigger Talmud Chacham than Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra, we don't know what he knew. He was a Bible commentator. Rashbam was a giant, right? The Rashbam didn't start his Shabbos. What's that?
Miser thinks that in his introduction to his edition of Ibn Ezra, he writes that he was also a great Talmudic scholar, and he quotes that one Tosos that he appears in. Everyone takes the tab on it.
It's ridiculous. I love Ibn Ezra, but the fact is, despite the Rav's claim that he and Rav Yehuda Levi, are the only two Rishonim who are part of the Mesorah, but even though we have no halachic works of theirs, I'm not so sure that that's correct. That they're part of the Mesorah, and people feel very comfortable rejecting Ibn Ezra. What's that?
What does that mean? Part of the Mesorah.
I don't know what that means. I will tell you, the reason why Ibn Ezra is part of the Mesorah is because the Ramban quotes him so much, even though mostly to attack him, not all the time, and because he was printed in Mikraos Gedolos. So basically, whatever, the fact that Ibn Ezra argues with Chivi does not make Chivi a bar plukta, okay? Ezra?
You could even say it differently. Like, why would we suggest alternative interpretations? I feel like that would just sometimes be a part of, when we study, when we learn, we try to come to the greatest understanding we can. So that could just be another way, a question.
I understand the argument against that though is, but the Gemara gave us the proper interpretation, right? So the question is, canonically,
the Gemara's interpretation, because look what was just said. Why would I say it? Meaning,
So obviously, to interpret, to understand the process of the Rishonim, how they approach a Gemara, their questions and answers, they may not come to the answer of that there could be an alternative interpretation, but they often are aware of the problems linking the two. This I think is the most significant and most controversial, most significant contribution of Mechkar to Talmud Torah, and it's also the most controversial one. Because you get in realia, certain bachur might sneer about a shir saying, oh, they do a lot of gersos there. But the fact is, you can't argue against the value of gersos. It might not be something that's fun to do all the time. Trust me, I've heard it. Okay, my rule here is that anybody who wants to describe to someone what the shir is without having been there, you can simply discount everything they have to say. That if you've been here, then you are entitled to offer a description. So you can't argue with the value of your souls. You may not want to do the work to get them, but the value is certainly there, and the value of reality. And again, you may not want to do the work, but certainly it's value. But the issue of layers and texts raises the possibility, the way certain, and those who've been with me know that we don't say it this way, even though I'm not denying the historical possibility. We don't say that the Gemara misunderstood Rava. We say the Gemara reinterpreted Rava or interpreted Rava differently. And it may have been different than original intent, and that's okay. And sometimes it may be a conscious process. It may be part of the nature of the way halachic interpretation worked. In the same way that the Amoraim don't argue with the Mishnah, but they may creatively interpret it and fully aware of the fact that what they're doing is sometimes dachuk, and that may have been, and why don't they argue with the Mishnah? The Kesef Mishnah in Hilchas Mamrim, I think Perek Gimel, claims because it was convention. Hilchas Kabasarai, the Amoraim, you should follow the Amoraim over the Tanaim. It was agreed upon convention, they wouldn't argue. Okay. If you cannot argue on them, it's like Akiras Davar Min HaTorah. Sometimes the Rishonim say, if it doesn't look like Akiras Davar Min HaTorah, then it's Mutar Ibn Bekum Vaaseh. Right? So if you can argue with the Mishnah, but not really argue with the Mishnah, you can reinterpret the Mishnah, that may have been an accepted form of canonical interpretation. Or interpretation of canonical sources when you really want to argue on them. So instead, you have to be able to interpret them in such a way. And, the more force, at some point, the interpretation is so forced, your opinion might be rejected, but sometimes dachuk ukimtas are accepted. So anyway, in the same sense, with respect to the stem of the Gemara, in many cases, it's not necessarily one of misunderstand. It doesn't have to be, even from intellectual perspective, one of misunderstanding. It may genuinely be reinterpretation. Now, again, I'm not denying the possibility. I don't believe in infallibility theories, but I think in terms of Kvod Chachamim and Kvod Torah, so there's a way to speak about it. And the way to speak about it is interpretation rather than error. Okay? Not because I deny the possibility. In the same sense, that, if the Sanhedrin issues a ruling, that this is an old question. Are they right because they're final or final because they're right? And I believe, fundamentally speaking, the answer is they're right because they're final. They may be right most of the time as well because they're right, but fundamentally speaking, at the end of the day, they're right because they're final.
Yes? I don't understand why, what you're saying the purpose is. Meaning, if I'm studying the Gemara, I'm studying the Gemara. I'm studying what's laid out over there. Why am I studying
Other possibilities?
Composite parts, yeah. So
they're basically, if I wanted to boil down, there are two reasons for entertaining the other possibilities. Number one, seeing the Gemara's possibility against the other possibilities enhances the understanding of the Gemara's possibility. The idea of seeing something in relief, you get a much clearer picture. Secondly, in terms of the interpretation of other sources, be they be Chazal or be it Rishonim, may depend heavily upon that in certain situations. To understand the Yerushalmi and the difference between Yerushalmi and the Bavli, rather than reducing it to a machlokus of what Rav said, there's a famous Rashi in Ksubas Daf Nun Zayin Amud Aleph, where the Gemara says there it's better to have a machlokes hamoraim about a subject than to have a machlokes of two hamoraim what a third amora said. And Rashi explains, because on the former you can say elu ve elu different kim chayim, and the latter you can't say. If it's a machlokes of what somebody said, so it's in that sense, theologically, we view there being something of an imperative to convert machlokas to a situation where it's not a machlokas of what somebody said, but a machlokas of what a particular statement meant, and therefore the possibilities come elu ve elu kim chayim. Now, I don't feel meshubah to that, as I don't feel the need to twist things to arrive at that, but I think basically both for the internal value of understanding the Gemara's choice versus the other possibilities, it's certainly worth exploring. If you take one, let me give you one concrete example what we did in this. And this comes back, if you didn't hand in your answer to the Bechina, I'm just not taking it now because I want to talk about it now, not because I'm mad at you. So, your last question.
I forgot.
I'm not angry. So the world doesn't end, but I want to use the example. If you take the example...
Can I walk out?
No, because it's more important to hear this. If you take the creative question on the Bechina, right, we introduced, I suggest that when you read the Mishnah Kipshuto, at least the one Mishnah, that the Machlokas for Elazar and Makiva might not be about what is pre, but, what you have to take Maisers from. Now, what the Mishnah in Orla demonstrated, I think not beyond the shadow of that, but pretty close to that, is that I'm wrong. Right? The Mishnah, and the number you, most of you who wrote in, who I got that part of the answer to, got it correctly, yes. In that, the Mishnah showed that clearly things that would not be a pre, Rabbi things that Rabbi Elazar still holds that Orla applies to Sap, despite the fact that that Orla must be only applies to Pri. It's Beferish, either Pri or Shom of the Pri. Sap is certainly not a Shom of the Pri. It must mean that he regards it as a Pri, and that since the same formulation of language is used in the Mishnah, Neshu Pri, it's clear that the argument in both places is about what is the Pri. Now, the fact is. That the possibility was worth what emerges from this is that when you look at the Mishnah Maisers, you could read one way or the other. The Bavli chooses to read one way, which I assume was because of its own interest in the sugya, and what seeing the other Mishnah, and you wouldn't have realized this otherwise, demonstrates that the Bavli may have had external considerations for reading the Mishnah the way it did. Okay, so the fact that I raised the possibility, even if ultimately it's rejected, in this case it was thoroughly rejected, right? It's wrong. But nonetheless, I think it puts it. Firstly, it helped us understand even more clearly the sheet of the Ramban, right? The Ramban, sort of digs up stirs up the mud and says, well, are they really arguing about pre across the board? So I think in that sense, it really put things in a much clearer light, having raised that possibility. Ultimately, it was rejected. It was also necessary because it highlighted what the Gemara was doing in linking Meiser, Orel, and Bracha, of sort of, leveling them with the steamroller and assuming the same standards apply to all of them.
So what?
So again, for the Ramban alone, it was worth raising the possibility. Right? Ezra?
I don't know if I'm asking the same thing as, but what do we do with this more rigorous understanding that we glean from Mecha? What were we doing with Gemara that now that we have this greater understanding, we can now do better?
So if you're
what do we have that they don't have? What do we get? What's the nafka mean then?
No. So if you're going to ask me halacha lemaisa, the answer is in this type of a case, in this type of analysis, this issue, realia will produce change halacha lemaisa. Will produce more proper interpretation. But if you're talking about this, the fact that one could have understood the amoraim differently, in its own right, does not change the halacha. So if the assumption is that you only learn lasuke shmaisa Aliba the Hilchasa in the narrow sense, then you're right. It's irrelevant. But basically, you're asking the question on at least the last 200 years of Gemara in the Ashkenazi world of yeshivas.
Oh, certainly.
Okay, but I'm taking that as a given that Torah lishma, that doesn't have to have practical nafgaminas in order to be valuable.
But do people who do mechar take that as a given?
So I will tell you
I would almost think not completely
so, certainly. So the truth is, that most of them, in some sense, do. Because many of us who do from the base medrash acknowledge from the start. What's that? So I was going to say, those people doing it in the academy don't care about halacha, and they're not poskim, so it's irrelevant. The real question is for those who are in the base medrash, and the answer is those who are in the base medrash acknowledge that it doesn't have, certainly not a direct impact upon halacha. But I will note to you, I haven't given this example, but there are machlokos or rishonim. We saw one sort of Rabbein Yonah and the Rif about the Kimcha Dechite, which was Alder Hadilma. I didn't prove it, but I have an explicit example. Ksubastav Tzadi Hamadaf, you look at the bottom Rashi, and I think it's the bottom Tosus, the Machlokas Rashi and Tosus, how to read the Gemara, all depends whether or not it's the stem of the Gemara speaking or whether it's Rava speaking. It completely changes the interpretation. In other words, the fact that, even for recognizing the alternative, sometimes the Rishonim do. Right? Now, the fact that the Rishonim recognized it, it became part of the legal process at an earlier stage. Again, it's not the most radical forms. In other words, it's not that the stem of the Gemara is understood. It's just a question of which part of who's the voice in the Gemara speaking. So that has very much relevance halacha lamaisa, right? So once an issue has been decided generally in halacha, we never sort of short circuit the process and go backwards as a general rule. So that's not a case of alternative interpretation of different than the Gemara interpreted, but it's already the most of the step is there. You have to first identify the layers in the Gemara to realize, to understand the machlokas are rishonim. Shlomo?
You wouldn't view that as intellectually dishonest, knowing that realia would impact halacha lemaisa.
Realia is different.
Realia, or the way that rishonim understood the sugya, which could be totally contrary to what the sugya meant. Meaning, if it has practical halacha lemaisa implications, it's not odd to be doing something that you know was...
Only if you're an original intent person. You know, think about constitutional law. Once you recognize that halacha is an organic system that develops, you can't go backwards in time. I would tell you, when it comes to realia, typically the realia issues are going to be more over the way, let's say, are going to be much shorter time distance. It's more typically going to be achronim, maybe rishonim. It's not that the Gemara is going to have a realia that they got wrong. You have to understand what the realia was. It tends to be some things that are much later, or will be an issue that's discussed in poskim more recently, not realizing what the Gemara's case was or something like that. But there are cases where, in other words, we would. Those who, and they may be a small minority, who would make an adama on oats, right, are acknowledging that. And the issue was always debated in theory, but it's not a new view that, that Shibol HaShul may not be Yotz. So it already is apparent among the Rishonim. Not in all situations, but realia to a greater extent, because realia is not about the Gemara, a different interpretation of Amoraim. It's not against the Bavli. It's not against the canonical interpretation of the Bavli, but rather it's against over an interpretation of the Bavli. I think that's a general issue. Look, even when Acharonim argue on Rishonim, on the relatively, it's not a common occurrence, they'll be arguing on the interpretation of Gemara, and they will be theoretically willing to ignore positions of the Rishonim. So that does exist. Aside from the fact generally we don't short-circuit the process, the Bavli is regarded as canonical. And so you'll ask, but maybe if Rava really meant something else. So I go back to if it troubles you so much, realize that it may not have been misunderstanding, it may have been a reinterpretation. And if you assume, you accept Hilchos HaKvasroi, the Vasroi in the Gemara, and this was the point I made with the Rabbi Yonah, is the stam of the Gemara. Yes, Shalom?
But then if that's true, so then just as much as the Gemara can reinterpret, and then that becomes halacha, so because we accept the Gemara, but we can also reinterpret as much as we want the Gemara, even against the Gemara,
so
as much as they could do that to
the Mishnah. So the answer, my response to that is, yes, it's true. And sometimes Rishonim or Achronim do give strained interpretations of the Gemara, although more typically defending particular practice, not to invent practice, which may have been frequently what the Amoraim were doing as well. When you look at the sugya about Chananya and the Chachamim and Shabbos, part of the reason for defending Chananya and trying to force it in there, I suggested at the time, was because the minhag in Bavel was to follow Chananya, who was a Babylonian Tana, and therefore, in effect, that's like what the Baalei HaTosfos are doing later. But even in the Gemara Shalom, when they reinterpret in the Mishnah, often it's rejected because they say that the reinterpretation doesn't work. So to the extent, you know, I remember, I won't say who it was. I don't mean Lignai, although he's probably elbow on the left edge of the community in Israel. A particular scholar was the Orthodox form, and I don't remember his example, but it's a good example. Commented to me, textual interpretation could interpret away almost anything. Okay, it's a little bit exaggerated, but the point is that you can be very creative. You can be very creative with ukimtas. Rishonim poskim do that all the time. Right? The Gemara's case is by, okay, and sometimes it's actually plausible, sometimes it's really not so plausible. So yes, the process of interpretation of the Bavli isn't dead, but if you're positing that the Gemara understood Rav as X, but you think Rav meant something else, that's irrelevant in terms of the halakhic process. But once you acknowledge that the Gemara did interpret it this way, so then it doesn't change anything. Yeah.
If we're going to say that the Gemara is consciously interpreting, then wouldn't it be important to look at why the Gemara is doing that? Why is the Gemara taking
that might be true for a historian's question. In other words,
the development of halacha and why or is it
when you talk about development, all the problem is that answers to that question most of 99% of the time are going to be purely speculative. It's going to be purely speculative. So it's not going to be any value. If you're a posek wanting to write that the Gemara interprets it this way because of Svara X, Y, and Z, or because of circumstances, that it's circumstances X, Y, and Z, and our circumstances are different, let's say. So you're already out on such a thin branch that nobody in the tradition of Psak, you know, even a maverick in tradition of Psak, is not going to go out on that limb.
Or that in terms of understanding the values present.
So that's a different issue. That you know, that is more relevant in the sense that, I'm generally reluctant to extract values from halacha in an absolute sense precisely because of the social component. So to that extent, yes, it's somewhat relevant, but that's true. In other words, you don't need to look there to find the alternative possibilities. We do things misvar the nafshe almost. Notice you take all the women's issues, for example. So those who would argue values, and there are recent basis to argue, plenty of ways reasons to argue against, though, appealing to the halacha purely for values, aside from the fact that there are halachas that transmit conflicting values, right? You know, a woman can make kiddush and can do all sorts of other things that even there be other men there and so on the one hand, versus things that she can't do, you know, which values are you supposed to extract? And you can't tell me that there's a value of a woman never doing anything for men. When the Mechaber writes, a woman can make kiddush and motzias and hanashim, and he attaches no stigma to it whatsoever, right? So what values do you pull out? And the answer is, you pull out the values that you want to pull out, right? If you really have an axe to grind, then you pull out tavol me'er lemisha ishtavanav marchem lo. And if you don't have an axe to grind, you pull out the kiddush. So values are much more nebulous in that sense. But when you're talking about for halachic purposes, so there, I think poskim are... Take it away out of this context, but similar thing or similar situations of that statistical probability, no posek would want to go on a little before, you know, unrelated to Mechakar. Okay, now a comment that's in order, and I had this, I know, I'm sure I did not talk about this here, I might have briefly alluded to it. How do you tell? So now I've stated there's a value in reading the Gemara and recognizing its layers, okay? There is a Tannaitic layer of the Gemara. That's pretty obvious. Sometimes there are Amoraic or Stam comments mixed into the Tannaitic layer. Those are often marked explicitly. When you have a statement in the middle of a long brisa that says, Asa'on lo Tanakama, you know, when it was a statement out of place and there's an editorial comment there, that statement actually goes back to an earlier Tana. You have examples. Take out Bar Ilan and just search for that expression, Asa'on lo Tanakama, you'll find many examples of that. There are other examples as well. Some of them are more subtle, where you have interpolations into the Tannaic materials. But that part should be less controversial generally, because people acknowledge that there's such a thing as brises and Mishnah is quoted in the Gemara, and it's hard to argue with that. The real question is, how do you tell the difference between the words in the Gemara that belong to Amoraim and those words that belong to the Gemara? Okay, the use of the term Gemara. Professor Halivni likes to use the term the Stam. He even has a term for a certain generation called the Stamoim. And the Rishonim, however, refer to it as the Gemara or the Shas. So the question is, what? Oh, hold on one second. So if you hold off 1 second on that. So one of the things that you have to consider, if you want to see a systematic treatment to this, and I don't agree with every one of his criteria, but I think on the whole it's a very thorough and useful treatment, is in Shama Friedman's Perakha Isha Rabba, which I think was his dissertation. It was published in, what's the blue line, Mechkarim, or some, I forget what, there's a series of these. But the library has, I'm sure it's probably on reserve. So in his introduction to Perakha Isha Rabba, which is I think the 10th parak or 11th parak of Yevamos, where he does, you know, his dissertation was the analysis of the sugyos there and so on. He gives you sort of a long introduction, part of which it discusses, you know, how one distinguishes, how one sorts the two layers out. Now, the one that is useful, and you have to be careful because you can get stuck in what the Israeli scholars call the magal ksamim, the circular logic, which is the assumption is that the words of the Stam are interpreting the Amoraim, and therefore it's easy to say that when you have an Amora statement, you have a Perush, so the Amora statement is Amoraic, and the Perush is Stam. The problem, of course, is that that only starts with your assumption in the first place, that the Perush is Stam. But there are typically, not all cases, in many cases, one of the distinguishing features, and I think this makes a much more compelling case, is language, that the Maimros, most of the time, certainly through Rav and Abayi, although that's when it starts to change a little bit, the Maimros are in Hebrew. Are in good rabbinic Hebrew, Mishnaic Hebrew, effectively, and the interpretation of the Gemara typically is in Aramaic. And so when you get a statement that's, you know, hybridized, you can often take the scissors and cut right in the middle and say, Ad kan lashon ha'amora, mikan ve'elech lashon ha'gemara. There are other types of situations that will tip you off. One of them we've encountered a couple of times already, which is when you have a brief presentation of the Machlokas Amoraim, followed by a repetition with an explanation, is a sign typically that the second part, again, there, you could have even broken apart the second statement, but it's pretty clear indication that first you have just what the Machlokas was, and then you have the interpretation of the Machlokas, which may not be always, doesn't have to be the original intent. And it's often interesting to try to piece together from where the Gemara extracted that. Now, here it's worth going on a little brief sidebar from a comment that we, for a chiddush that we suggested a couple of years ago when we were learning Kiddushin. And here I want to talk about for another moment the change in attitude. And I think we've encountered, we haven't encountered any good examples in Ketzad Mevarchin, but when the general assumption we work with is when the Gemara says Amar of Ploni or Amar Lei, that it's the Amora speaking. However, there are situations in the Gemara, and I even though you could argue I'm not being, you know, that I should basically throw everything into question, I'm only willing to question it when there's really grounds for questioning it. The possibility that a quotation is not a quotation. One of the sources, and again, I'm going to send this out. I'm not doing all these today because I'm sort of compacting this part, but there is the Gemara in Megillah quotes a statement, Rav Yitzchak Nafcha, that Rosh Chodesh Adar Shecholios B'Shabbos, you take out three Sifrei Torah. Then they quote Rav Yitzchak Nafcha saying the same thing by Shabbos Chanukah, right? Rosh Chodesh Teves Shecholios B'Shabbos, you take out three Sifrei Torah. So the Gemara says, the Gemara suggests that you could have told us one of the two, and the other one we would have known from the, we could have extrapolated from the other. And the Gemara answers, Achada Mechlal Chaverta Itmar. One was said, it was Itamar, from the other one, meaning he only said one. And yet the Gemara quotes two different statements, Amar Rabbi Yitzchak Nafcha. Right? Or, alternatively, to take a different sugya, B'Metziyav Daf Lamed Vav, where there's a machlokas, Rav and Rabbi Yochanan, Shomer Shemasa L'Shomer. If a Shomer hands over an object, he entrusted to someone else to watch, whether you pater or you chayev. And they quote Rav as saying his pater. And then the Gemara says the following. The Gemara says, Rav Chista, Rav's Talmud says, or next generation, Chista says that Hadar Rav Lav Beferishit Mar Ela Mechlala. Rav never said it; it was inferred from one of his actions. And the conclusion of the Gemara is Velohi. It's wrong. Shani Hasam. That case, Rav Paskin the way he did, not because he held Shomer Shemasa L'Shomer was Putter, but he had a different reason. It was an unusual case. So here the Gemara claims that, in fact, what was originally cited as a statement of Rav, Rav Chista says Rav never said, and the Gemara claims that Rav never even meant it. Chavtesa Midbeis. So one of the things you have to, and this phenomenon of La Befer Shitmar El Mechlala Itmar, it wasn't stated explicitly but was inferred, sometimes the Gemara accepts it, sometimes it rejects it. There are about 20 places in Shas where you have that. Now again, I'm not going to claim that those are the only 20 places, but I work with an assumption, I think you've seen this already, that when there's an Amar and Amar Lay, unless there's grounds for assuming it's not, oh, we did encounter one. Unless there's grounds for assuming not so, you assume that it's an original quotation. We did. The statement of Rav and Shmuel, Lama Hamid Beis, about Mizonos, that Ein Mevarchim Barim Mizonos El Hamesh Asmin Da Mavad, Rav and Shmuel never said. What they said was that kol sheyesh bo mechamesh asmine dagam and kol shehu chamesh asmine dagam mevrachem berim mezonos. The Gemara on Lamehamed Beis is basically its interpretation of those two statements put together, which we're about to get to the beginning of next week in Shir. We encountered a case a couple of years ago, a famous statement, the Rav, Mekadesh b'milva eina mekudeshes. And there the Yushalmi seems to have a completely different view of Rav's view. And we pointed out that there's a statement that Gemara actually has, I think, in the beginning of the third parak in Kiddushin, about Nisach Lamos, Yimekadesh a woman la'achar shloshim yom. I think that was the sugi it was based upon, where Rav said something, and the Gemara, the Bavli, understood Rav's statement one way, and based upon that, they assumed Rav held Mekadesh milva eina mekudeshes. There is another way of reading it that the Yushalmi introduces in the second parak. So we suggested, again, can't prove it, that Rav never said Mekadesh milva eina mekudeshes. Rav said what he said on the other statement, and that was the Mechla Chavertimar, but there's another way of interpreting what Rav said, and that's tremendously significant. So that possibility always exists, but I think that that's the last resort. Only when you have grounds for assuming that he didn't say it, you have some evidence, not just because, oh, you, it'd be better, you know. So we assume that it is a quotation, it is to be accepted as an accurate attribution, unless there's grounds for assuming that it's an extrapolation. Again, I certainly don't assume that anybody, as opposed to Neusner, you know, things that they may have invented things that put in people's mouths, I don't accept that approach at all. It's either an explicit quotation, or it's a mechlach averta. It's based upon a different statement Rav or the Amor said, and it's an extrapolation. And again, it's possible the extrapolation is not what he meant, as the Gemara itself points out in many of these cases when it says, no, velohi, and that's the wrong interpretation. So I don't think one has to be limited to those cases in the Gemara, but you have to be on very solid grounds in order to say that. But when you have explicit quotations or attributions, you accept that. But the question is, where do you cut things apart? So language is one of the best gauges. It breaks down later in the Gemara simply because the Amoraim may be speaking more Aramaic, or at least their Maimers, I don't know what they were speaking, they're probably all speaking Aramaic, but their Maimers tend to be formulated in Aramaic, and therefore that can no longer serve as a dividing point, in the same way that it's very hard to tell all those passages in the Gemara that came from the Halachos Gedolos. It's hard to know that they're from the Halachos Gedolos because he wrote in Bavli Aramaic, in effect, so you can't distinguish on linguistic grounds, or not easily, at least, on linguistic grounds alone. Question of dating of the Stam. It's more a scholarly question, but I think it's relevant even in our cases. The assumption of some, like Halivni, and they say he's backtracked a little bit. I haven't read his most recent introduction, or his most recent work, but his assumption is that the Stam of the Gemara is all late. I think that that is a highly dubious proposition. I think most of the Stam of the Gemara can be assumed to be late, but I think there are certainly material already beginning with Abaye and Rava, which you have to assume as a given, that there's a fair amount of stam that already begins in the fourth generation. And I think there are occasionally stamas that may be earlier than that, but I'll admit that they're the exception, not the rule, Chaim.
Right, didn't we see, I forgot if it was last year or the year before, where we saw that there was like an example of like an early stam.
I think there are early stams. Right. Again, I think you don't start with that assumption, but you have to consider that possibility, Eitan.
Well, we view an earlier stam as a commonly known understanding of loket or I always think of the stam as, you know, when it was being redacted, the redactor is putting down an explanation.
But you're assuming that it's if you don't realize, you're sort of taking not quite a Neusnerian like approach, that it's all sort of one final product as opposed to sugyas being built over generations.
I'm assuming that you have a visible redactor.
I think that you do, but he may be starting with, just as he's starting with earlier members of Amoraim, he may be starting with earlier proto-sugyas.
Right, so that's what I'm saying. So
the stam of the Gemara, so you may have parts of the stam that are in fact very relatively early. Now that's
what were these? Like, were they?
I'll call them proto-sugyas. In other words, the sugya had started in a formation. There may be pieces that are added in later, both at the end and in the middle. But the fact is that there are certain cases where you look at the stam of the Gemara, and it's almost necessary to assume the Amoraim were responding to that particular stamma. And that's one of the signs. What Halivni tries to do, and what Professor Weiss, who taught a long time in Revel, he was Feldblum's Rebbe, you know, has in one of his works, I think it's a Yitzhak, yeah. Hayitzira Sifrutit Shel Amoraim, where he tries to demonstrate a lot of cases, and he may be right in these cases, a lot of cases where it appears that this earlier stamma is really a later.
His son for Mali Gavoa, he did the same thing.
Okay, what, in the sense of always trying to show it's later?
Yeah, no, that they're early stamma. He was trying to show that they're early stamma.
I haven't read his book in a long time. I read it for my comps a good number of years ago now. But my recollection is he has a number of examples showing where you even though it looks like the Stam is early, it's not. I'm not saying that he adopts an Halivni-like position. So I think that there are early Stams. And that matters because the earlier a Stam is, and as if the Stam dates to Abaye and Rava, then in effect the interpretation becomes almost much closer to original intent, you know, or definitively.
Everything else you view it as, you know, a certain Tana or a certain Amora said this. You're attributing it to an individual, but with the Stam, you don't do that. So I'm just trying to understand what was it exactly. If you view it as the work of a redactor, you're saying, well, at the end, someone.
He's reconstructing the dialogue between statements, in effect. But sometimes it appears that when an Amora didn't say something, but Abaye is responding to something, it sounds like he's responding to the anonymous voice, which was the B'nai HaBeis Medrash or something like that, and that was there. Now, it's often hard to demonstrate because you can often say and go back, well, the Stam of the Gemara put it in, and then the Gemara later put it in. But there are cases where it becomes very hard to argue that he's responding to something, and if it's not that, it means there must have been a quotation that was lost. That's the alternative, and that's not very appealing. That's why it's more appealing to assume that sometimes those in-between pieces are, in fact, representative early development of a sugya. I will tell you that probably finding things before the time of Bayan Rava will be exceedingly rare, unlikely and rare. Let's put it that way. But starting with Rava and Bayanon, I think the process begins. Shlomo?
Late? What do you mean?
Late? Late. We don't know when the Bavli was finished. It's a pretty good bet that it's finished by the end of the 6th century. I assume it's, again, when you say finished, right? The Bavli wasn't finished until the Vilna Shas. But, right, there's still emendations going on. But if you want to talk about more or less, in other words, intentional editing, as opposed to, let's say, Bahag type stuff, which was unintentional, I assume it's finished no later than the year 600, or, you know, thereabouts. You know, and we don't know that, you know, and we don't know who exactly is Rabbanan Savarai and so on. I can't get into, you know, Halivni, I think, has Stamayim versus Savarayim. I don't think we know. You know, you have named authorities. At some point, you lose the named authorities. It's purely anonymous. I assume during that, you know, the last, you know, 150 years or 160 years after Ashi's death was the time in which the Gemara was basically finished. Chaim?
According to the sort of view that you're saying right now, would one technically have been able to, in the late 4th century, pick up a scroll of, like, proto-Gemara, where it had, like...
No, the only evidence to such a Gemara, to the only evidence to the word, and that's what the word Gemara means, in the Amorite period that I'm aware of, is a Gemara somewhere in Erevin, where there's a discussion about something and about what the Maimer was, and he said, Kavitu lebe Gemara, he asked him. Did you put it in the Gemara? It sounded like you had a fixed collection of statements and Maimeras that were sort of transmitted. I doubt they wrote them down.
But if you had this early... I mean, the only way you could have a Stam is if there is some sort of written record. Otherwise, why would there be such a thing?
No, you can have oral transmission. It's not clear at all when the Gemara was written down exactly. That's still a very big debate. You know, one of Shama Friedman's claims, and I believe he's wrong on this, but nonetheless, it's, I think, illustrative, is that when you find a lot of shinui nischos in it, it's an indication of lateness and the Stam, as if somehow the variegation on the oral stage is preserved in the manuscripts, and I don't really buy that. But bottom line is that I think that if you went in the Amoraic period, I don't doubt, even if you didn't have Stam in the Gemara, you had Maimers, certainly, and you may have had ways people understood them, but those, when you don't have something in a fixed form, it changes more easily. That's why the Doravi claims that the Bavli is binding, because it became a Torah Shebichsav, no longer a Torah Shebalpeh. That's his theology there. Shalom?
I mean, when we talk about there isn't a Stam in the earlier generation, there isn't a Sugya, and there still is a redaction of statements, though, because you have, like, Itmar, Ravamar, like, you have a case, and then Itmar, Ravamar, X, and Shalom, Rx.
Okay, but that could be the work of the later editors anyway. They could have two members of Rav and Shmuel next to each other in their tradition, and they could just put them down and present it as Itamar and so on.
Right, but it could also be just the way the issue transmitted the tradition in, like,
I
that could be an earlier version.
I agree. Another observation generally, even within the late time, I don't know how many layers there are. It's impossible generally to distinguish, but you have to consider the possibility that it could be more than one layer, even within that. It's very hard to distinguish. I mean, it becomes a guessing it. Did we?
Where you saw if you took out, like, the middle stump,
Okay. I don't remember the case. If you can dig it out, I'd be appreciative. Ezra?
I just don't know what Sean was saying. In Leib Moskvitz has this work where he demonstrates how the increasing complexity of like conceptualization...
Well, by and Rav are the first briskers, basically.
Even Tanaim, there's implicit conceptualization. And by Amorim, there is a limited amount. But in reference to the writing, Rav Elman talks about how like, the 1.8 million...
It's doctor, by the way. He knows more than most rabbis, but I think he would tell you he doesn't have smicha.
Dr.
He
Elman.
Could get it any day he wanted, but he goes...
Dr. Elman talks about the 1.8 million words in the Gemara, and he said that the entire like the writing system, writing something in a codex, he said he was talking about how maybe it didn't appear until I don't remember. He said the 8th century, and before then, writing it on a scroll would have been like wouldn't have even been possible. So I think he indicates even like a later date.
Writing it down may not occur to well into the Gaonic period, is my assumption. You know, the Rambam writes in Hilchos. Malva Velova, I think. It's a famous passage when he said, he was talking about Pitin, and then he said a certain manuscript came to him, and he says, that's I don't know, that looks Karov L'Chamesh Me'o Shanim. Which, of course, now, the Rambam probably had no way whatsoever of being able to determine the age of the thing. Now, if you would believe that, and I don't, not that he was making it up, he just thought it was, that would put writing back into the 600s. But it's doubtful the manuscript that he had, that it came, that Ksav Yad, that actually was that old. And it's doubtful that anything was actually written down, at least that at that stage. Even the Mishnah itself is hotly disputed when the Mishnah was written down. That's one of the differences in the Igeres Rosh Hashanah between the Spanish and the French version when it was. So the Gemara is also, they're both sort of, their origins are shrouded in a little bit of mystery in this regard. Okay. So anyways, that basically is why it's really important, why potentially, again, I would not chas v'shalom denigrate those who don't study, seeing layers in the Gemara, but that's why I think it's so important in terms of a clearer understanding of the shaka entire of the Gemara, is to be aware of these issues. Now, I won't make two comments in regards to this. Number one, there are a number of Rishonim, it's very clear, the Balei Tosfos particularly, but I suspect most Rishonim, who were very well aware of the distinction in layers, and it was second nature for them to see it in the Gemara. There's one Tosfos that a former student of mine, Rabbi David Polsky, once showed me. Can you hear me Shabbos for a second? Daf Dalet Amud Aleph in Tosfos, the bottom Tosfos, where Tosfos, the Gemara has a statement.
Where is
it? Daf Dalet Amud Aleph.
Where?
Oh, Shabbos, I'm sorry. Where the Gemara... The Gemara says the following. It says that Rabbah, the Gemara wanted to answer no to a certain question, and Rabbah says it's Rabbi Akiva who holds that you don't need a makom dalet al dalet. And then he quotes a Mishnah. And in the statement, in the process of quoting it, the Gemara says, Rabbi Akiva sa amrina inklut the kemishon chadamya, Rabbanan savi lo amrina inklut the kemishon chadamya. So the Gemara then comments, it says, Lameima the pshita le the rabbi, the beklut the kemishon chadamya, pligi, that they argue, that Rabbi Akiva ham arguing about it. So Tosis points out, the Gemara just presented Rabbah as quoting the Mishnah, and Rabbah is saying that Rabbi Akiva holds klut the kemishon chadamya, chamod al klut the lav kemishon chadamya. So Tosfos asked the following question. How did the Gemara know that Rabbah held that the Machlokas was about Klut HaKemishon Chadanya? So Tosfos says, and if you'll tell me, because it was just stated before when Rabbah quoted the Mishnah, so the Tosfos says that if that language, Tosfos says that Im Hayinu Omrim Hadakamar Le'el Rabbi Kiva Samar Klut HaKemishon Chadanya Rabbanon Hakomi Divrei Rabbahi, if those were Rabbah's words, Hava Asi Shapir. Then, in fact, we don't understand why the Gemara thought that Rabbah must have held Klut HaKemishon, that the Machlokas was about Klut HaKemishon Chadanya. Ach ein nira shehemi divrei Rabbah. That's all Tosfos says. He doesn't explain why. He just says it doesn't appear that those are Rabbah's words. How did Tosfos know? He doesn't say those couldn't be Rabbah's words because of X, Y, and Z. He just says ein nira, because he had a chush for the language of the Gemara. He had a sense of when Rabbah was speaking, when the Gemara was speaking, and when it was the Gemara filling it in. And therefore, Tosfos has to search for an alternative proof that the Gemara knew that Rabbah held that the Machlokas was about the Kemishon Chadamya. So it was sort of a chush. So I point this out because the Rishonim, many Rishonim, I think, if not, I won't say all of them, certainly had a hush for this particular issue, for reading the Gemara. They just read Gemara really well. Today, nobody likes to read text, but they read really well. Maybe it's partially because they had almost no commentaries to study. And I say that not jokingly. In other words, when you have hundreds of Rishonim Acharonim to read, so you don't really think about the text, you just think about the interpreters. When all you have, you know, all Rashi had basically was a Gemara. I don't know, how did Rashi learn Gemara without Rashi? I don't know. Okay. Yeah, Rashbam right. At least learned Chumash with Rashi. But had he learned, so Rashi, when he learned Gemara, he had traditions of his Rabbein, but basically he was looking at a raw text of the Gemara. So when all you look at is that text of the Gemara, you start to have supervision. Okay, but if you're looking at everything around it, you don't see it. But many of the Rishonim, if not most of the Rishonim, probably had this vision. A. And B, in reference to you, as not necessarily having this vision, although some of you probably are already more skilled at it, it's like any skill. It's like riding a bike. If you do it for a long enough time, it becomes instinct. It becomes a chush immediately. You can sort of tell. You can spot it miles away, what's going on in the Gemara. When you first do it, and I know this was my personal experience even 6-7 years ago, at first, when you first start to do it, you have to struggle, you read a Gemara, you have to stop and parse and think. At a certain point, you look at a Gemara, you just sort of know what's coming in terms of who's speaking. It becomes almost second nature paying attention. But I think that there's great value in paying attention to it for the reasons that we've stated until now. And I think that is probably that is among the greatest contributions that Mechkar has in terms of B'nai Torah learning in the Beis Medrash. As I said earlier, and even more recently, virtually none of these things are new to the Rishonim. The notion of multiple interpretations of the Gemara, of an Amora statement, are frequent in the Balei HaTosos. I mean, frequent, I'll tell you 200 times, but they say, you find many places in Shas. And when I send out the sources, again, if you finish Ksubas tomorrow, you can prepare, and you're interested in doing these, you can start to look at the materials I send you and figure out why I send you each of them, what their relevance is. I'm just not going through, with the examples. You'll see more examples of this, but I think that as I've said in the past, and been not misquoted, but, quoted in the wrong context by certain people, a Talmud Chacham who comes to study Gemara should have many tools in his toolbox. The most important tool, I think, is to not come in with any preconceptions. But after that, conceptual analysis is a very important tool, and so is textual analysis and all the various pieces of Mechkar. And if a person can only deal with a Gemara in one fashion, it basically becomes a meat grinder. And you just pump in the Gemara and the Rishonim, you come out with seven possibilities in each of three Rishonim and so on and so forth. And most people who do that don't do a very good job with it. Some people do it are pretty good with it. But I think that it's important not to approach the Gemara with preconceptions how you're going to learn the Gemara, but to let the Gemara speak to you, and therefore you have to be prepared to take more than one approach. And I think those who've been here any length of time and even not realize that conceptual analysis certainly plays a serious role. I don't want to wait the amount of time dedicated to each, but it's simply, just as I think you don't dismiss textual possibilities, you also don't dismiss Balabatish possibilities. Of course, that doesn't mean there can't be conceptual issues that underlie the differences as well, and those are important also. But to have only one set of tools for analysis, I think, simply produces a much less rich interpretation of Torah. Now, I want to turn my attention now to the Sugya and Ksubas, just to get it started.